I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Scott Loughclass, a litigation partner at Fried Frank and vice chairman of the firm. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be with you always.
So we're going to talk about your career on today's podcast, how you came to the law, then how you came to focus on Delaware litigation, how you chose Fried Frank as the place really to build your career. Then we're going to talk a little bit about developments in Delaware, which is the field in which you practice and something I focus on very closely, of course. And then finally, since this is the fourth in a podcast miniseries with law firm leaders, we're going to talk about your role in management at Fried Frank, how you came to management, and what you enjoy about being a law firm manager. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the law and how you came to focus on Delaware litigation.
I mean, David, you've known me a while, but even if you didn't, and assuming you had something close to 20/20 vision, you'd probably quickly conclude that there was no sort of athleticism in my high school experience or any kind of star turn that was going to happen on any kind of football field or basketball court. So I had to choose a different path early on. And I would say that from the earliest of times I can remember, and I have a mom who scrapbooks a lot, so I can look at a lot of school projects that confirm this, I always said I wanted to go to law school. But as hard as I rack my brain, I can't think of when that idea first formed or the reason behind it. But I do know that it began to develop and grow during high school and college when I did a lot of speech and debate. And in doing those activities, started to develop the skill sets that I think lend oneself to being, you know, a pretty good litigator. It's actually funny because earlier this week, I was at an event for the lawyers division of the UJA Federation, and I ran into three different people who I did college debate with at different schools and competed against, who are partners at Skadden, Paul Weiss and Sullivan and Cromwell. So I think it's not an uncommon path for people who participate in those activities.
And then talk about law school and making the transition from debate to then in practice being a litigator, and what's similar and what's different there.
Look, I think in debate, you learn how to express yourself, how to feel comfortable in different rooms, but also, and probably most importantly, how to read your audience and figure out what's working and what's not working, and to abandon very quickly what's not working and choose path on your feet. And the reality is, when you're helping to teach someone who's younger at the firm about how to take a deposition, the best advice you give them is you have an outline, you're prepared with potential questions, but you need to be comfortable going off script, so to speak, and course correcting about the line of questions you're asking, or know when to stop or know when to start, or know when to take a completely different approach. And it's no different, frankly, when you're on your feet arguing in front of a judge and you're making an argument that you can see in the body language of the judge before whom you're appearing, that the arguments that you are making are not being bought and that you need to change path or else you're going to have a pretty bad outcome. So I think a lot of it is just becoming more comfortable with uncertainty and becoming more comfortable with having to read body language and kind of applying a bit of EQ along with IQ.
And then how did you come to focus on Delaware litigation? Delaware obviously being the center of corporate litigation in the United States.
So when I graduated UVA Law School, I started my career at Wachtell Lipton, and Wachtell Lipton has a large concentration in what I'll call like Delaware deal litigation or M&A litigation, even if it's not in Delaware. So I think from a vocational and a sort of focused perspective, that's a lot of what the firm does, and therefore a lot of what I did early in my career. But beyond just simply the fact that there's a high volume of that work at Wachtell, I think there was something that appealed to me a great deal about that type of litigation. And that it's, if you look at the things that people criticize litigation as a choice in career for the most, what are they? Number one, it's that litigation can go on for years and years and be tedious, and you can be caught up on one big case for years and years. And the reality is Delaware deal litigation typically is circumscribed in terms of timing by the timing of the transaction. It's often driven by preliminary injunction motions, trying to block a projected shareholder vote or a projected closing of the transaction. So they're a little bit more fast-paced, and then they're over, usually. And that creates a little bit more diversity in the type of experiences you have. Another example is that because they move so quickly, oftentimes you get to do more of the core activities, depositions, motion practices, oral argument, more quickly and not spread over a number of years. So in many ways, if you have a busy Delaware practice, in my opinion, you get up the learning curve of being a litigator a little bit more quickly in terms of the individual skill sets and muscles that you get to exercise. The other thing I would say, which I think is interesting about being a transactional litigator, is that you have an opportunity real time to shape the facts of the matters you're working on. Oftentimes in normal civil litigation, there's an event that took place, a breach, a debate, a dispute. And the reality is people don't have huge disagreements about what happened. They have a disagreement about what the impact is of what happened, particularly in damages. In Delaware deal litigation, you're often in the boardroom shaping the facts that you're ultimately going to litigate as the litigation is unfolding or as you're sizing the risk of potential future litigation. And I think for a litigator, that's a particularly empowering part of your practice because you're not just sort of somebody who's looking at a static set of facts and debating what the impact of those facts are. You have an influence over the evolution of those facts. And that can be a pretty exciting thing, particularly for a younger lawyer.
So as a younger lawyer with that kind of a litigation practice, you're often thrown into situations that you may not feel totally ready for. How did you manage those challenges?
Look, there's a couple things I think that lawyers are very reluctant to talk about or be honest about. And I think this is one of them. And the reality is, particularly young in your career, I think everyone goes through a degree of imposter syndrome. They say to themselves, I'm in this room, I'm litigating a $25 billion transaction. There are really super and well-credentialed lawyers all around me. There's really well-credentialed judges sitting in front of me. You know, do I have the background? Have I been up the learning curve? What am I doing in this room? And I think you have to be honest with yourself that everybody else in the room went through a period of time where they were in the same situation. And I think kind of embracing that unknown and embracing the fact that you have a steep learning curve you have to go up is important. And I think one of the things that I focused on early in my career, and I encourage friends of mine and mentees of mine to focus on as well, is you always should look for two mentors in every situation. You should look for the mentor that's inside the situation you're experiencing and then a mentor outside of the situation. Let me give you an example. Early in my career, I had wonderful mentors. At Wachtell Lipton, I had Bill Savitt, who's now the co-managing partner of Wachtell Lipton, who was and remains a close mentor and friend of mine. But I also looked at other firms I worked with, partners at those firms who I didn't see every day, who I didn't have in the day-to-day experience of being at the firm, who became really important mentors and who had the benefit of some distance from what I was experiencing to give me good advice. People like Bill Lafferty at Morris Nichols, Jay Cohen, who's a retired partner at Paul Weiss. These are people who are really important to me in helping giving me advice on how to grow as a lawyer, how to get more comfortable with the unknown, what direction I wanted my career to take. And one of the things I try to do is when I work on a matter with another firm and there's a younger lawyer who is eager to learn and ambitious and seems to be focused on the right things, after the matter concludes, I'll reach out to that person and say, look, if you ever want to chat, if you ever just want to have someone outside of the situation to talk to, I'm here and I'm happy to do that. I think it's a really important part of being a young lawyer and figuring things out.
Did people do that for you, or how did you go about building those relationships with older lawyers at other firms? Because that takes a lot of confidence as an associate to do.
Well, the reality is I think a lot of people from the mentor, not the mentee side, actually are very avuncular and are looking for opportunities to pass on what they've learned and help guide people's careers. And I think you just need to have your eyes open and your ears open to those people, where they are and who they are. I think when you finish a deposition and a partner from another law firm is kind of small talking with you afterwards, you should lean into that conversation and ask questions and follow up afterwards and say, hey, do you want to grab a cup of coffee or dinner? And people are really good about actually lending support to you and what you're going through. I mean, one of the things that, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about is, we recently instituted a lateral integration program at Fried Frank, which applies not only to lateral partners who come over from other firms, but organic partners who progress through our ranks and become partners here. Each one of those partners is assigned two lateral integration partners. One is within their practice group, who's going to know their day-to-day, know the flow of their work, know the challenges of their particular practice. And then someone's in a completely different practice who's not going to interact with them every day. And I think that second person is often the most important person to helping somebody integrate and grow within a firm, because that's the person that has a little bit of distance, has a little bit more perspective, and doesn't necessarily have the perspective bias that someone who's closer to you has. So I think those people are out there and I think they're eager to help. And you just need to be willing to take the help. You don't even necessarily have to ask for it. You just have to have your eyes open when it's being offered to you so you don't miss the opportunity.
And then talk about when you knew that you were going to build a career in this specialty and then how you thought about building your own practice in that specialty.
So I think it was when I first attended the Tulane M&A conference in New Orleans. So every year there's this large conference where M&A lawyers, litigators who practice in the area, judges, reporters, media, investment bankers, proxy solicitors all descend into the Roosevelt Hotel in New Orleans and have a two-day series of panels and panel discussion. And what I saw the first time I went down there, first of all, I again want to talk about imposter syndrome. The first time you go down there, it is the most intimidating thing in the world. You sit in the audience and you see basically 8 or 9 panels of people who all seem to know each other like their family, know each other's families, know each other's practices, have inside jokes, and you feel a little bit like an outsider. But what you see really quickly is the degree of intellectual interest and curiosity they have about corporate law, the degree to which that law evolves through these debates and discussions they have on these panels, and the extent to which the law itself reflects a series of policy judgments and balancing. And I think seeing that up close was intoxicating. I think it really made me feel like this could be a practice that takes you out from behind a desk and puts you into a universe of some thought leadership. And then when you add to it the fact that by definition, a transactional litigation practice requires close collaboration with corporate partners and with clients directly in boardrooms, it sort of took all of the things that are great about litigation and bolted on top of them all the things that's great about a more advisory or corporate-based practice. I think it makes you a better and more well-rounded lawyer. So I would say about 4 to 5 years into my practice, I started to really gravitate towards doing more and more of these transactions. And then like anything else, you show interest in a little bit of more and people will give you an opportunity for more. I asked to start being included in the corporate teamwork and in the boardroom and earlier on in the transaction planning. And the theory effectively was, and it remains, if you're in the room and helping to develop the corporate transaction with an eye and an ear towards potential risk down the road, you can make better transaction planning decisions for your clients to better prepare them and mitigate for the future risk. And then once you start doing that, you just feel like you're in the mix on everything. And that was a really, frankly, attractive thing for me, particularly earlier in my career.
And then talk about how, over a number of years, you went about and continue to go about building that practice.
Look, I think a core part of it is participating in the thought leadership. I think it's really important to digest and read all the cases that come out of Delaware, to be somebody who publishes on those cases and I think is willing to take sometimes strident views on what those cases mean in terms of the impact on corporate law and corporate practice. I think networking into the universe of people who likewise participate in that thought leadership is important. I think being incredibly aggressive about being out there with actual and potential clients to talk to them about not only where the law is, but where you think the law is heading. I think you have to fully immerse yourself. I think once you do that, clients will be more likely to reach out to you or look to you as the provider of advice. I mean, look, one of the things I always say to our incoming first year associates at the firm is there is no greater validation you can have in your career than knowing that a client who, if they're paying your rates, can pay the rates of almost any lawyer on the street. Out of all the lawyers in the city or all the lawyers in the country, they're choosing to come for you or to you for your advice. That's an incredibly validating feeling. And frankly, and I say this to first year lawyers too, if that doesn't kind of get your energy level up, you probably ought to find something else to do because that frankly is the most important part of everything. And to me, the more you're out there in the world and you're trying to learn about your craft and you're trying to communicate with others who know about theirs and you're willing to admit when you're wrong and admit when there's more to learn, I think that that really creates a little bit of a patina around you about not only expertise, but judgment and open-mindedness. And I think you've just got to deploy that into the universe of people who are looking for your services. But the reality is, you know, you go to Tulane and you see all these really talented lawyers and judges, and you have to be willing to go into those sessions realizing you have a lot to learn. And clients, I think, gravitate towards people who seem to have more than one perspective and to be aware of other people's perspectives. So one of the things I'm very open about when a client comes to me for advice on a Delaware law issue is I'll say, look, this is what I think the right answer is. But just so you know, if you went and talked to these three firms over here, who may be a little bit more aggressive or a little bit more conservative in their transaction planning, here's what they'll tell you and why. And if you have these judges here who've expressed these views in these cases, while they aren't yet fully the operative law and they've been expressed through dicta, this is where I think the law is heading. And you should probably know that before we go forward with this. I think that's how you really build up the expertise and the judgment. And I think you also, particularly in a corporate litigation context, there's no substitute for learning the business, meaning learning your client's business needs, learning your client's focus on a particular transaction. The corporate partners with whom I worked early in my career really instilled that in me, that you're not going to go be able to litigate disclosures around a tender offer if you don't truly understand why the tender offer was selected as the structure rather than a long form merger, for example, what the key issues were with the projections, the key challenges and headwinds that were facing the business, why doing or not doing a market check made a lot of sense for that particular board of directors, and why deciding to do a transaction now rather than waiting 12 months was the right business decision. If you don't really dive in to understand the client's business, you're not going to be able to manage the litigation risk or the litigation, and you're not going to be able to give good advice on disclosure issues. So it really has to be a fully immersive experience.
You mentioned lateral partners earlier. You came to Freed Frank as a lateral. Talk about the process of figuring out earlier in your career which firm was right for you and what you were looking for in a law firm.
Look, I think the first thing you have to start with there is a recognition that the law firm you're practicing in, whatever firm anyone is practicing in, is not the only law firm that does excellent work for excellent clients with excellent people. There's a lot of wonderful firms out there, and you should look back at the firms you've spent time in, if it's more than one, and focus on all the wonderful things that firm provided you and the great opportunities and mentorship and training that those firms provided you. And then I think you have to ask yourself a singular question. It's a question you don't often ask yourself in your career, which is, what is the law firm that lets me best be the best version of myself, not the best, right? I often say to people, you should always look to be the best version of you, not the best. And the reality is that firms have different cultures and they have different personalities. And the thing about Freed Frank that attracted me so much to the firm and frankly causes me such an unbelievable amount of love and affection for the firm is we do not have a view of what is a Freed Frank partner. In other words, we're not looking for a specific thing. And when people get here, we're not trying to make someone fit into some kind of mold. We actually embrace the differences between our lawyers and their personalities and their styles and their judgment. And we take the view that we need to have people who have different ways of succeeding and different styles of success. And that makes the place a better and more enriched place. And it makes our offerings to clients, I think, much more varied and therefore more able to fit into different client needs. What I like about it here, which I think is important, is we sort of take people where they are and we let them be the fullest version of themselves and we let them try to be the most extreme and satisfied and professionally happy version of whoever they are. And for some people, that might mean that you're a really introverted, quiet, deliberate, super careful, cerebral, bookish lawyer. For someone else, it might be that you have a lot of flair and a lot of style and a lot of room-filling presence. For other people, it might be that you measure twice and cut once. For someone else, it might be that they generally jump in front of an issue. And the reality is that when people interview here, they're always surprised at how different each of the partners and associates and special counsel are that they've worked with. And I think that's a really considerable strength of the firm. So when I think about what it is I like here, what I like here is I don't feel like I'm at a firm of me's. And I don't feel like I'm at a firm of any one particular personality. I feel like I'm at a firm where I have a real variety of personalities I interact with every day. I feel it's a really collaborative place. And I actually feel, and I think this owes in large measure to the one thing we kind of do look for, which is people who are interested in going all in on the firm and making this a home for themselves. What I really love is how much people bring of themselves to the office every day. that isn't work related. So one of the things I say at the firm a lot is I can't stand it when people say that law firms are like families. The reason I say that is you only have one family. That's near and dear to your heart. That's sacrosanct. I think that's its own thing. But what we are is a place where you can go to find professional and personal satisfaction at the same time. My kids love coming in the office. Like, it's a really bizarre thing that when my kids have a day off for school or a half day, they'll ask if they can come with me to work. And I get into the office super early. I get into the office at 6:30, which means when they come to visit, they come to the office at 6:30. And they'll be here for 12, 13, 14 hours in the day, bouncing around between people's offices, playing board games with associates, counsel, partners, people in business services and conference rooms. I give them a key card. They go to the cafeteria. They go to the associates lounge. It's a great place. And I actually think it's really hard with work-life balance to find the right boundaries. And in some ways, I think having your family be a part of your experience at your firm and having your firm understand you and your family makes you better able to do your job and frankly makes the job a much more pleasant experience. So I'm really grateful that this is an environment and it's something that we work hard to sustain and to grow where individuals feel like their personal life isn't boundaried off. And in some ways that makes everything a lot easier for them.
Switching gears a little bit, there have been pretty significant changes proposed to the Delaware General Corporation Law, which is essentially Delaware's corporate law code. Those were proposed in mid-February. They've occasioned an enormous amount of comment and in some circles, criticism. What's your take on the proposed amendments?
Look, it's obviously become an exceedingly controversial topic. I have a couple of takes on it. The first is, I really do lament the extent to which everything right now around the discussion about these amendments has become super polarized and super extreme. And what I mean by that is I like to think that everybody coming to the question, judges who've issued opinions that have been critiqued or questioned, those people made those decisions in good faith with an honest and true belief that it was the best decision at the time and in the best interests of Delaware and the best interests of corporate law. People who are proposing the amendments think that they are in the best interest of corporate law. People that oppose the amendments think they're the best interest of corporate law to oppose them. I wish we weren't as extreme in our rhetoric about it. When I look on LinkedIn, when I look on some of the media posts, I mean, people are using words like war to describe what's going on in Delaware. The reality is there's an unfortunate amount of conflict going out around in the world that is war that's probably not getting enough attention. Let's use and limit those words for those situations. And let's not attack people, right? We can debate ideas, but we don't need to attack people. So when there are judges that are coming under fire, when there are legislators that are coming under fire, advocates and opponents, I just wish all of them were given a little bit more respect for why they're doing things. I think they're all doing things because they believe in them. And people may disagree with each other about those things, but we should limit the disagreement to the things and not to the people. I think at the end of the day, when I look at these amendments, I think to myself that they reflect a bit of a recalibration of risk and an assessment of policy incentives, just like any type of Delaware corporate law calibration must. I think people are getting distracted a bit by trying to measure how many cases are being overturned, if any, how different things are going to be. And the reality is the debate should focus on, okay, assume these amendments are in place, which is what's being proposed. What do the policy incentives look like in that circumstance? Is that a normatively good or a bad thing? Will that result in good or bad behavior? Will that result in something that's stable or unstable? And I think when you look at it through that prism, the amendments become in some ways a lot less controversial. And in some ways, people are raising healthy debates on some of the topics. But I think that when I net everything out, I think the amendments are good for Delaware. The challenge is line drawing. Whenever you propose line drawing, people will debate where you're drawing the line. So let's use an example. In the status quo, the question of whether someone is or is not a controlling shareholder is easy if they have 51% of the voting power. It's hard if they don't. Someone who has less than 50% of voting power can still be a controller if they have actual management and actual impact on the material decisions of a board of directors, which is a mix of questions of how many board seats do they have? How much voting control do they have? And there's a million sliding scales that are all subjective. And these things are often decided on motions to dismiss, where you have to make reasonable inferences in the favor of the people who have reached and made the pleading in the complaint. And it's very, very challenging. And I think it's hard on the judges and it's hard on the litigants and it's hard for predictability.
Well, and in a number of cases, lower court judges have asked the Delaware Supreme Court to provide more guidance. And there's been an assumption that there would be more guidance coming at some point, because it is, as you say, a very difficult question.
Yeah, and I'm not so sure. Look, I'm not sure whether those judges would think that they've asked for the guidance so much as they've acknowledged the challenge. But the reality is it's in the state legislature's ambit to decide to provide the guidance. And they're drawing a line. And one of the things that they've done in these amendments is drawn a line at, I think, 33% of ownership. And the reality is you could debate whether that line should be 20, 42, 37. Once you've decided to draw a line, you're going to have a debate over whether and where the line should be drawn. But at the end of the day, I think it is not debatable that once you've drawn a line and once we've all lived with a line for more than 15 minutes, it will be more stable and predictable because there will be something specific that is objective that can be looked to. I think that people have lost a little bit of sight of that, that measuring this based on how different it'll be on day one, in my view, isn't the way to look at it. It's more assume that we've had to live with it for a year. How do we think it looks? What do we think the incentives are? What do we think the behaviors are?
Switching to law firm management, talk about how you got involved in management and why it was appealing to you to take a large role in the management of your firm.
So I'll start by saying that, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, there is no more consequential thing I'll do in my career than working on behalf of my 190 partners to help, along with Ken Rosch and Steve Epstein, manage the law firm on a day-to-day basis. It's an incredibly heavy job, and it's one that I take incredibly seriously. The reality is that this was attractive to me because there is no institution in my life that has given me more, changed my life more, or meant more to my family and to me than Fried Frank. And the opportunity to play some small role in continuing to help the firm in an upward trajectory and being a better place for everybody who works here and an attractive place for people who don't work here, that's an incredibly, incredibly attractive thing in one's career. I have an immense amount of gratitude to this firm for what it's done for me. And I think the things that made this firm appealing to me can only be made stronger. How did I get involved? The reality is there's always formal and informal things that you do that kind of help evolve into a more formal leadership role. You know, earlier in my career at Fried Frank, I served on a number of committees. I volunteered for a number of subcommittees and working groups to work on various aspects of the firm, whether that's firm governance or negotiating and extending our lease, looking at where we should be located, et cetera. And that gives you a lot of exposure to different people at the firm and to the business of the firm. And the firm made a decision this past year to have the leadership responsibility broken up into three people and to allow each of those three people to continue their careers. And that was an important component of each of the three of us finding it to be an attractive opportunity, was the ability to keep practicing law. And I think that having it broken up into three people gives you a lot of opportunity to have different perspectives infused into almost every decision at the firm, which I think is a good thing, because the collective wisdom of a group is always going to be greater than the wisdom of any one person. And I think that it also gives at our firm, when you think about the demographics of the three of us, our chairman, Ken Rosch, is in his early 60s. Steve Epstein, our managing partner, is in his early 50s. I'm vice chairman in my mid 40s. There's sort of a different place, if you will, within the firm for each of those arcs in their careers, and therefore a different perspective on what people at that point in their career are focused on. But also in terms of our partners, three different people they can talk to when they're going through something or they want to get a perspective or they want to share a perspective. And I think that's a really powerful construct at a law firm.
You described earlier going to Tulane and just the social aspect of the Delaware litigation bar. Compare kind of the socialization within that group, managing those relationships, to socialization required of a senior manager at a law firm.
Look, I think at the end of the day, the legal industry is a human capital business. It's a people business, right? Our clients are people and they have problems and they want to talk through their problems. And we as lawyers are people who go through our own emotional range of issues and have our own biases and predispositions and styles and judgment and approaches. And I think you've got to be willing to go out there, whether it's at Tulane or it's at Fried Frank or any other firm, and go out and meet as many people as you can, listen to them, understand what's important to them, and get a feel, if you will, for the collective energy around any particular issue. You're not going to make everybody happy. And in fact, it's almost a recipe for shorter, long-term unpopularity. But you got to go out there and make sure that you're listening as much as you're talking. And frankly, when I think about things I try to work on actively to make sure I'm doing a better job, it's that. It's making sure that I'm not out there just talking, that I'm out there listening. And that can sometimes be hard. And I'm sure in a moment of unguarded honesty or otherwise, a lot of my partners would say I could do a better job on that. And everyone I think can. But what Tulane shows you and the Delaware Bar shows you is that everybody comes at these issues differently and everybody has a different perspective and everybody has a different lived-in experience. And you've got to make sure that you're going around and buying in each of those perspectives to your thinking so that you don't have an overly myopic view on any one particular issue, whether that's an issue of Delaware corporate law or that's an issue of law firm management.
What do you see as the greatest challenges for your firm and big law generally in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years?
Look, I think the number one challenge at Fried Frank is the number one challenge at every big law firm, which is how do you attract, promote, and retain the best talent? The reality is it's an incredibly hyper competitive legal market. And our people are under siege, as are people at every single firm, from other firms and from headhunters trying to make arguments about how to displace this person or that person or why the grass is greener on the other side. And I think you have to assume that just like in an M&A takeover, when someone reaches out to a target, they will offer them more to induce them to sell. I think that you're always going to have a situation where there's someone else in the market who's willing to call your people and in the short term, offer them more money. So the question is, have you created a durable enough place and stickiness within the place and the people involved in it that they view the firm as a destination and somewhere they want to be and people they want to be partners with and people they want to be in business with? I think that extends beyond simply making it a good place to practice law. I think you need to make it a good place to come to work every day. So one of the things we've been working on, Ken, Steve, and I, and a lot of our partners, is how do you make and maintain Fried Frank as a destination workplace? So we have a speaker series now, and we'll have high profile folks like authors, judges come in and do Q&A and panel discussions. We recently had Nate Silver, the author and the founder of 538, come in and speak to all of our folks at the firm and then sit for a Q&A. Making the place somewhere that you get excited to go and that you're proud to be at. And also making sure that it's a place that when somebody is not happy about something, they feel comfortable coming to you and talking about it, right? We say here a lot, we shouldn't suffer in silence and we shouldn't succeed in silence. And I think both of those things are really important. So the human capital part of the business makes it the case that everybody is always under siege, so to speak. And it's important to make sure that you've created a durable culture and a place that people want to be at.
And then finally, how do you decompress from the job?
I don't know that I'm all that great at it. So I have a few things that I decompress with. The first and the top of the list is my family, in particular, my kids. Everyone that knows me knows that I'm a sucker for doing things with my kids. I love watching my son live out athleticism that I never got to enjoy in baseball and basketball. My daughter is a free-spirited 11-year-old who likes to do sewing and jewelry design and acting and voice lessons and voice classes. And, you know, I'll follow her around anywhere watching her perform just about anything. My family is a series of rabid New York Knicks fans. The reality is we go to Madison Square Garden a lot. We love it there. I enjoy, as silly as it is, I watch completely terrible television with my wife and we watch it in spades. So if there's a bad TV show, we'll probably be watching it. I'll never forget being at a dinner with a client because we were with our significant others. My wife slipped and made some comment about how we had just recently watched an episode of Love is Blind, which I assure you is not something you need to watch, but it's something I need to watch. And the client jumped in. This is like a billionaire CEO of a company and said, "Oh my God, are you caught up? I want to make sure I don't spoil anything for you." And we had a 45-minute conversation about Love is Blind. So the reality is that I think I look for some simplicity outside the office, like, you know, given how many hyper-stress situations happen inside the office.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much, David. Appreciate being here.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.